The ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus is famous for this observation: we cannot step into the same river twice. That is, if we stand at the bank and put in a foot, the water flows by, always changing. If we run down the riverbank to catch up to the water we felt at first immersion, we can't be sure we've got the same water. In any case, the scenery at the riverbank is new. It's the same river, but it's always changing. I propose to you that our Unitarian Universalist tradition is like a river. It's always flowing, never quite the same. Some people don't like to swim in a river. They prefer a pond where nothing new will come floating by. Even better is a swimming pool, well maintained, kept as pure as possible with chemical treatments. Actually, for swimming, I prefer a pool. But for my religious community, I like the sensation of a brisk, flowing current. 100 years ago, the Reverend Louis B. Fisher talked about this dynamic in another way. He was the dean of our Universalist Seminary at St. Lawrence University. Fisher said, "Universalists are often asked to tell where they stand. The only true answer is that we do not stand at all. We move." Among some Unitarian Universalists, these metaphors of constant movement can cause discomfort and stress. How can I ever get a handle on this thing if it's moving all the time? If our faith is just an ever-flowing stream, what's constant about it? What keeps us coherent as a tradition? And what is familiar? And, most important, how can I explain it to other people if it's always changing? Some people complain, "I'm not happy about these changes," while other people express frustration and impatience that changes aren't happening fast enough. This dynamic of change has been with our movement since the early days. The flowing streams of religious liberalism have not always been tranquil streams. Certainly, we've had our moments of white water rapids. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony of the 1600s and 1700s, the air was thick and cold with Orthodox Puritan Calvinism. In that chilling doctrine of human depravity, everybody was born bad, sick, depraved, and sinful. None of us deserved any divine favor. Concerning heaven and hell, all of us were at the mercy of God, seen by the Puritans more as a fickle judge than as a loving parent. There was nothing you could do about your spiritual destiny except to hope that you were among the lucky few, the elect few, who were going to go to heaven. Can you imagine living in such a scary climate? Well, into the midst of that spiritual cesspool came a countervailing current, the clear water of reason, love, conscience, and spiritual freedom. Eventually, there were some liberal ministers leading those Puritan congregations, and those guys dared to give people hope. And they were all men back then. The big splash came in 1819 when Boston minister William Ellery Channing delivered a sermon entitled "Unitarian Christianity." This was back when attention spans were long and no Super Bowl waited at home on the television. So Channing took 90 minutes to give the sermon at the ordination of a younger minister down in Baltimore. Here's my summary of his bullet points. God gave us minds and hearts. We have learned how to think and how to love. So let us read the scriptures with our faculty of reason and our own true hearts. And reading the Bible carefully, we can understand Jesus of Nazareth as a prophet a healer, and a man, the best human example to follow in life. So let us follow his teachings without making him into a god. His human life teaches us the potential in every human life. He shows us that we all have worth, dignity, and the possibility for growing in goodness. Channing said, we can grow in likeness to God. No sooner had William Ellery Channing returned from Baltimore to Boston than his long sermon had been printed and reprinted, spread around, celebrated, and attacked. Channing's big splash brought theological differences out into the open. Ministers took sides. Some congregations came apart. Often it was the liberals who kept the church property and the Orthodox believers who had to leave and build a church someplace else. Usually it was around the corner. The liberals became known as Unitarians and the Orthodox as Congregationalists. Less than 20 years after those daring heresies of liberal Christians like Channing, a younger bunch of radical Unitarians threw cold water in their faces. These were the transcendentalist thinkers like Margaret Fuller, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Elizabeth Peabody, and Henry David Thoreau. They wrote, human spirituality is too big to fit in an old stone church on the village green. In small study groups of men and women, and in large lecture halls, they proclaimed, religious experience comes as much from the natural world as from a church. Religious insight comes as much from your own heart as it does from a book written by men long ago. Ralph Waldo Emerson left the Unitarian ministry after only 3 years, and then he spread his ideas on the lecture circuit and in essays. And while he was doing that, he was invited by the graduating class of Harvard's Divinity School in 1838 to give their commencement address. And he did. Emerson said shocking things to this young, new generation of clergy, these young men who had been sent to seminary by their loyal Unitarian parents. Emerson said, you don't need to go to church to find God or to feel God. You don't need to read the Bible to find the truth. Look to your own intuition. He said, write your own Bibles as insights come to you. You could say Emerson did a cannonball dive. Afterwards, many traditional Unitarians were appalled by his message. One critic named it the foulest atheism. Another one said it was the latest form of infidelity. Harvard's Unitarian professors were angry and they were embarrassed. To their Orthodox critics, Emerson's words confirmed the stereotype. Unitarianism was a slippery slope to perverted religion, to no religion, to damnation. Unitarian Christianity and the Divinity School Address. These were two of the fiercest whitewater currents that our forebears managed to navigate on the river of our tradition. Yet they didn't merely wander into those rapids, they brought them on by bringing their ideas and beliefs out into the open. Over the centuries, Universalist and Unitarian congregation members have been stretched to make room for new views, new ideas, new ways of speaking and being. They were not always comfortable with the changes or with change in general. Questions would recur. How can we ever get a handle on this thing if it keeps moving? What is it that holds us together amid all this change? I think that all through our journey, all through the journey of our heritage, we have been carried along by one strong current which continues to carry us. And this current brings with it ever-sustaining values, always discernible in our movement's history. You can identify the values that carry you forward in it, but I propose two primary ones from our spiritual current. One is the dignity of every one. The other is the depth of our interconnections. Every single person has worth just by virtue of our humanity. That's not my idea. It flows in our current, in our heritage. Next, all beings are interconnected, including us. Humans are mutually dependent with the rest of the natural world. Humans are mutually dependent with one another. From this current come our views of life, our sense of purpose, and our call to action. The dignity of everyone and the depth of our interconnections. This is the current that stays with us, keeps us going, no matter the change of scenery as we move down the river. Look, here comes more whitewater. In the middle of the 1800s, Unitarian people and ideas were spreading to the Midwest and the Great Plains. Free-thinking church people preached less about the Bible or Jesus or even God as they addressed the meaning of life and the ethical choices of their day. It's notable that in the middle of the 1800s, in the middle of the continent, women became clergy for the first time. Not welcome at Harvard's Divinity School yet, or at most churches in the Northeast yet, liberal women attended a new Unitarian seminary in Meadville, Pennsylvania, near Pittsburgh. From there, newly graduated ministers headed west. Back east, traditional Unitarians, no doubt harumphed about those women ministers. They definitely fretted about this new ethically based preaching without reference to the Christian scriptures. How can you be a Unitarian without basing your deeds on God's will? How can a Unitarian ignore the words of Jesus of Nazareth? Their fretful doubts did not stop the current. In the middle of the 1800s, in Iowa, Nebraska, and Illinois, women like the Reverend Mary Augusta Safford organized 18 congregations and ministered to them and ministered to their wider communities. In the middle of the continent, the current carried us, the dignity of every one and the depth of our interconnections. In the early 1900s, traditional Unitarians and Universalists took in the discoveries of geologists about the age of the earth and theories from Charles Darwin about evolution. The most challenging of his theories was the idea that human beings had evolved from other forms of life. The Unitarians wrestled with Darwin's ideas but adopted them faster than most other denominations. In some Universalist congregations, Darwin's ideas did cause distress at first, but eventually they accepted those theories. In a Universalist theology, it came to be seen that Charles Darwin had shown the means and the method by which a loving and creative spirit had brought everything into being, including us. To the religiously orthodox, of course, evolution was an outrage, as it is now to fundamentalists. To the religious liberals, evolution was a wonder. Now let's leap downstream a few decades or skip down the riverbank. Three times in the 20th century, the two denominations, Universalists and Unitarians, considered merging into one. But it didn't happen until 1961. One cause for the delay was the Second World War. Other causes were fear of change and fear of losing what was most familiar and reassuring. That's an understandable worry. By the 1950s, the Universalists were a smaller group than they had been in the 1800s, and they were smaller than the Unitarian denomination. One minister has described the pre-merger fears this way. Some of the Universalist people worried about being swallowed whole by the American Unitarian Association. The Unitarians, for their part, worried about getting indigestion. The two groups had gotten well acquainted before the formal merger. They had consolidated the publication of religious education materials and a hymnal. In 1954, their two national youth organizations merged, taking the new name Liberal Religious Youth. Full consolidation came at a General Assembly in 1961, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. In 1963, we published a new hymnal, this blue book. It's a lovely collection of hymns and readings. It has a picture of a tree on the front. Looks like one of our trees around here. Over time, however, we learned that this book was too narrow to hold our widening river of human experience and religious expression. For example, reflecting its time of non-inclusive gender terms, this blue book has sections of music and readings entitled The Arts of Man, and another category is just named Man, and lots of songs and readings about brotherhood, too. Later, we would choose to speak about brothers and sisters. Now, some of us are using even less gender-dependent phrases, like the human family, human kinship, and kindred. It was 3 decades before we appointed a commission to make a new hymnal to replace this one. That is the Gray Hymnal, introduced in 1993. And then, as you might expect, came the complaints and the arguments. I missed that hymn. Why did you leave it out? Why did you change these words? They were perfectly fine, and this substitution doesn't make any sense. What's this one doing in here? It's totally unsingable. The complaints, however, lasted only for 10 or 20 years. By and large, our congregations are happy with our gray 1993 hymnal. And I know ministers in other denominations who admire us for the religious variety of our songs and our readings in this hymnal. In recent years, we've been having conversations about how some of the words in the hymns are not as inclusive as they seemed back in 1993. I am used to these conversations and not worried about them. If we didn't see some white water rapids now and then, I would worry that we were no longer feeling the current. But the current bears us along with the values that have always been part of this movement, the dignity of every one and the depth of our interconnection. Speaking of interconnections, we're interconnected here. And I have a question for you. How many of you were not here last week, either because this is your first time here or because you were absent last week? Raise your hand. All right. It's good to see you today. And, you know, there were people here last week who were not here today. This is the same congregation that was here last week, but it's a different congregation. This is the same congregation that was here in 1960, but it's a different congregation. Every new visitor, every new member changes who we are and what we are. Everyone and everyone's presence adds variety in perspective, experience, talents, and needs. Yet as we change and grow, the current bears us on together. I hope I don't shock you, but some people choose whether to attend a given service or not based on the sermon topic, or the preacher, or the musicians for the day, or something else. Perhaps it's whether we have soup after the service. Today we do, by the way. You may not enjoy every part of a Sunday service or connect with every part of a Sunday service, but your presence here makes it possible for someone else to experience and receive what they need. You may loathe certain hymns, but someone around you may find one phrase to be inspiring or one measure of music to be comforting. You may feel nothing during the prayer or the words of meditation, but another hears just what their weary spirit was thirsting to hear. We do not come here for ourselves alone. We come here for the depth of our interconnections. You never know what benefit your presence may have on other people. You cannot predict when your kind words or warm greeting or helpful gesture might make a difference. Your presence just sitting there might be reassuring to someone who got up in the morning and said to themselves, I need to be around other people, and they bring themselves here. None of us has to meet everyone's needs in this community. Even the ministers and the other staff here are not able to do that all the time. But in community, we can receive experiences that we could not provide for our solitary selves. In coming together, we give so many blessings to one another, and we receive them. You may not be here every Sunday, but on the Sundays you are here, it makes a difference. All the ways, all the times that you show up or help out or give of yourself or participate on any day of the week, all of those ways make a difference in the depths of our interconnections. You are here and it makes a difference. Thank you for dipping your toe in the flow of this current, this river, this stream that bears us all. Thank you for adding your energy to this inspiring and reliable current. Blessed be. And amen.